Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Heartland Politics on KBUR AM-FM here in Burlington, Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today, after weeks of talking with Democratic presidential candidates and analyzing the results of the 2020 Iowa caucuses, we're going to return to examine some of the forces shaping our economy and culture that directly impact our politics. This has been a focus of my show since I first started here nearly 6 years ago, and today I'm really looking forward to this because my guest is an author of a new book that has really caught my attention. I learned about it on social media. It got some great reviews, and I read it, and I've been chomping at the bit to interview the author, and finally we get a chance to today. But the book really examines some timely issues involving the class divide in the United States. And it's really eye-opening, and I've given a lot of thought to why I thought it was really provocative, but I'll save that for the author. His name's Chris Arnotti. He's with us today, and the book is called Dignity, Seeking Respect in Back Row America. Chris, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
We'll start off, you didn't come to writing this book by a normal sense that an author would. I think part of the interesting aspect of this book is your background and how you came to write a book focused on what you refer to as back row America.
Right. I was a Wall Street trader for 20 years, in 2012, I quit my job to focus on my photography and writing and exploring what I call back row America, which I think a lot of other people would call places left behind America, heartland, forgotten America, places of poverty and places where drug addiction and is spiking and where communities are losing their populations.
Well, you started off right in your backyard there, visiting an area in the New York area. How did you? I mean, take us through that timeline of how you came to. I mean, why did you pick that area? And I think it's interesting too how you got there.
Right. If your listeners know New York City very well, I was living in basically near downtown Manhattan or Brooklyn. And I would spend my weekends going on long walks, often 20-mile walks, just throughout the entire city, the length of the city. I'd take the subway to the end and then walk home. It was my way of relaxing, but it was also my way of learning and just kind of getting outside my bubble, as it were. And eventually I came into a community called Hunts Point in the Bronx. It's New York City's poorest neighborhood. It's it's probably something very few tourists ever go to, it, if they ever do. It's only 15 minutes away from New York City's wealthiest neighborhood, but it's very, very different. It's got a lot of social problems, a lot of addiction. But I think 60% of the 60% of the people live below the poverty line, and it's 99% Black and Hispanic. And I'm neither Black or Hispanic, and so. I stuck out a little bit when I first went in there, but I ended up spending about 3 years with a group of homeless addicts who lived in the community and documenting their lives and their struggles, and both through photography and through writing. And I ended up spending so much time up there. I was so drawn into the community and so drawn in by what I saw there and the frustrations I saw there and the political consequences of this neighborhood that I ended up basically quitting my job and doing this full time, and going beyond the Bronx, and going to places like Iowa, going pretty much everywhere in the United States. I put 350,000 miles on my car driving over the course of 5 years all around the United States.
And you went to places where you were told not to go.
That's right. Part of the reason I was drawn into Hunts Point was because when I mentioned that I was walking in the Bronx that particular day, that first time, someone told me, whatever you do, don't go to Hunts Point. So, of course, I had to go there. That's just who I am. But I also wanted to see why people told me not to go there. And what I found there was the stereotypes of what people told me not to go there for existed, but you know, drugs and sex work and poverty and crime. But what also existed there was the title of my book, A Lot of Dignity, a lot of residents doing their best to maintain a sense of dignity, to find dignity in a world that wasn't giving them very much, in a system that wasn't giving them very much. And that sort of process, go to a place people told me not to go, and then consequently seeing both things that might not, that the media talks more about, like crime and addiction, but also seeing a great dignity and community within the residents, it was what I saw all across the United States, both rural, urban, white, black, Hispanic. You know, I saw it in parts of Iowa. I saw it in parts of, you know, New Mexico. I saw it everywhere.
I think the first thing you got to do when you read this, folks, and I can't recommend buying this book enough, is be prepared, open your mind up a little bit, take your blinders off, because I think what Chris does here, what you do here is really invite us into this world, and we may not want to go, but we have to. This is our country. And you talk about, again, we like to prejudge or judge people that are on drugs, but you kind of give a different angle of this. You're not necessarily standing up or defending necessarily, but you kind of put it in their shoes where you've got to have empathy for the position they're in.
Right. One of the things I hope that comes across in the book, and what I do is I spend a lot of time, as much as my story is interesting, and I know lots of people like to listen to it, I try not to put my story in there as much as put the stories of the people I've met. I mean, I've probably interviewed and taken photos. I mean, I've took 70,000 photos over the last 7 years. I interviewed probably, you know, 10,000 people. And the people I interviewed were people that generally, you know, are very much on what people would call on the cusp of society, people we tend not to look at or don't want to really interact with sometimes. You know, it's people who've had a rough run recently or maybe had a rough run for a long time. And, you know, one of the things I hope that comes across in the book is allowing you, the reader, to hear their stories, to look at their images, and then, you know, maybe think a little bit more before rushing to judgment when you look at somebody who's going through a rough patch.
I thought it was really interesting, the part on religion, of the people talking religion and their faith in places where we wouldn't expect it necessarily.
Right. One of the things, you know, I jokingly say that when I started this project, you know, I had been a banker, but I was also, prior to being a banker, I was a physicist. I got a PhD in particle physics. And so when I started this project, I jokingly say that I was a vegetarian atheist. And when I finished it, I was a meat-eating agnostic, or at least a meat-eating churchgoer. You know, one of the things I saw throughout my entire project, and my goal was not to it's to simply tell the readers what I saw, not to judge necessarily, you know. And so even though I myself didn't come into this project religious, I came away from realizing how important religion was to so many communities and so many people who have so little. And, you know, one of the things I did in this project is to go to church. I would go to services in these communities. You know, I say when I entered a community, I would try to spend as much time there as possible. I mean, it wasn't just a day. It was often, you know, 3 weeks. And I would spend time in the McDonald's. So we can talk about that later. McDonald's mm-hmm. became essential to where I would spend time. I would spend time in McDonald's. I'd spend time in churches. I'd spend time in community colleges. You know, and these were the places that where I really met people and I heard their stories, and I got to see in more in depth just what really mattered to them, what really drove them and gave them a sense of meaning, really. And in churches, you know, I would go to about 2 services a week. It didn't matter what denomination. I spent as much time, you know. But I've been to almost every denomination, a service of every denomination at this point. And, you know, it was just really powerful what I saw there. And so that's what, you know, on a personal level, that's probably the biggest change in my life is a newfound respect for religion that came out of this project.
It's interesting to me, too. the role of community here, where people find community and hold on to it. It may not be what we traditionally look at, what the rest of us have. And I want to talk about that too, but how we set the rules for defining everybody else. They can find community in different places, and that kind of leads into the role of McDonald's in the research you did.
Right. You know, I didn't go to McDonald's a lot except when I was, you know, a banker, beyond, you know, maybe taking my kids once in a while to quiet them. but when I was doing this project, hanging out with effectively was, you know, the most the poorest of Americans, I found myself in a McDonald's a lot because that's where they were. And they weren't just there for, you know, inexpensive good food, which it has, but they're there because they could spend 5 hours there sitting, reading a newspaper, and talking to other people on their terms, you know, and basically rejoin polite society and not be as judged. They've escaped the weather, get free Wi-Fi, often get a charging station, charge up their phone, and just interact. But not only the poorest people, but, you know, you go into any small town in America or any neighborhood in America, especially rural ones, and you go to there's a morning group of regulars at the McDonald's, you know, who generally older residents, but not always, who get together every morning, sometimes at 6, sometimes at 8, to get together and talk politics, talk families, talk whatever, and have coffee. And it really serves a central role. McDonald's serves a central role as almost a community center in many of these towns. And often in poor African-American communities, it is the community center. It's probably the one place. You know, I talk about this when I go to Gary, Indiana, where the McDonald's effectively serves as kind of the most functional center where people, a community center almost for almost the entire community.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on KBUR AM/FM, Burlington, Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. My guest today is author Chris Arnotti, who's recently written a book that came out called Dignity, Seeking Respect in Back Row America. We've been talking a little bit about the book here. Chris has been describing what led him to write it, some of the themes involved in it, the role of community. A couple of the things I want to get to in our time. And one of the things I focused on in the show, Chris, is the impact of globalization on our economy here in the Midwest, and that's one of the things that really attracted me to this book. And you kind of put this as one of the leading causes of what's led to this. I think it's fair to say the expansion of back row America.
Right. I talk about. You know, one of the things the political class, the elites, I call them the front row. I use the classroom analogy, because I think education is pretty much our biggest divide in America right now. Mm-hmm. But what I call the front row, and especially the political front row, looks at things in a very narrow they look at policy in a very narrow definition of success or failure. It just simply, does a GDP grow? You know, does my spreadsheet measure more stuff being made? And they don't think of the negative consequences of policy, which is often communities being destroyed. You know, free trade is a perfect example, you know, both with Mexico and with China, and where I think one of the losses was communities that lost their factories. And when they lost their factories, they lost everything. They, you know, the stable job you could get out of high school, that you could then use to build a family and stay in your community and be an integral part of your community and go to church and go to bowling leagues and do all those things, you know, that stable communities do, was gone. And these communities, you know, with the factory gone, with the jobs, with anxiety-free jobs in the sense that you could have enough stability to build a life, gone, so much collapsed. And, you know, I often say hope left. And in the absence of hope, drugs and despair came in. It's really quite depressing to have seen it all over, you know, America. These things which... You know, I had supported NAFTA back then, and I probably supported China trade agreement back then. But when you know, when I saw the negative consequences of it, you know, Battle Creek, Michigan, a town that used to make, you know, cereal for so much America, its factories are, so many of its factories now are in Mexico, and it's facing a lot of problems.
That's the similar story for our listeners out here, Burlington, Iowa, right here where our show originates. I did some research back in 1970, probably the apex of our manufacturing economy. We had almost 40% of our jobs in manufacturing, and the median incomes were near the national average. Now we're down about half the jobs, and the median incomes are down to about two-thirds of national average. And the problems in, left in its wake are just as deep of what you describe. I mean, I related directly to that. But what's interesting is, you know, the response was by the elites, folks, you remember this, was, well, we're going to create job training programs, and we're going to take you, and you're going to no longer work in the factory, a 50-year-old male or female working in the factory with a high school degree, and we're going to retrain you and do different jobs. But that kind of follows what I thought was really interesting part here was our expectations for what others do, the rules we set without any understanding of the hurdles and obstacles that are there.
Right. One of the things I try to get across in my book is so often when the political class, the front row, the political elite, see a policy, think about poverty, or they think about struggling communities, they try to only offer them help to become like themselves, to become like their front row. They only think of the solution being, well, I'm going to help you do what I would do, not go into the communities and say, okay, what do you want? You know, like, right, how do you measure success? Because not everybody measures success as going to an elite education, building a resume, getting credentials, and going, picking up and moving out of your community and going to New York City or San Francisco. That's not necessarily what everybody wants to do, but even more than that, very few people can really do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think our elite understand how narrow the path to success in the United States is, and how consequently excludes so many people from the very beginning. You know, I want to just go back to the lost factories, because it's not just lost jobs. I mean, it's lost identity. It's lost meaning. You know, at this point, I don't mean this offensively to a lot of your viewers, I think a lot of people, a lot of elites look down at people who stay in their community. Mm-hmm. They look at people who stay in their town, and they basically see them as being losers because they're not succeeding. You know, they're not doing – that's never a good attitude towards anybody, but it's certainly not a good attitude of politicians towards voters to look down at them.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was going to mention the identity issue here because you know, we're told a lot by folks, again, the elites, well, you know, you can go take a job. If you lose your job in Burlington, hey, we've got a job open. They need welders out in Denver, Colorado. Pack up and go. And it's not that easy, is it?
No, I mean, that's the other, probably the biggest thing, or my biggest frustration with political elites is, or the policy class or the front row, is this idea that, you know, when they see a dying community, and this is true on both the left and the right, they'll see a dying community or a community that's struggling, and they'll say, well, just move. Why don't people just move? And without fully understanding how important place is, you know, especially for poorer or less wealthy individuals, one of the few things you're gifted at birth is your community and it being meaningful to you. And that can take a lot of forms. It can take, you know, finding the forest around you beautiful, finding the mountains around you beautiful, but it's also about, you know, family. It's about identity as a member, you know, of your smaller town or what have you. That means something to you. That gives you a role. And not everybody when you tell people that role has no value, you're taking one of the few forms of value away from basically from less fortunate people.
I think, and for our listeners here immediately trying to categorize this as conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, this book isn't. You don't approach it that way. And there's no hint here of what Chris Arnotti's views are. That's what I liked about the book. So don't be thinking that way. Don't approach the book that way if you get it, because I think that's one of the values of it. But, you talk about here, again, these issues are not easy to address. And you really cast doubt on whether they can be even addressed like by national programs, coming down and trying to solve these issues at the local level.
I'm sorry, I physically didn't hear your question.
No, that's okay. Just, you question whether, beyond that, you're very doubtful that national type programs are going to be able to adequately address these issues, these problems.
That's right. Part of my frustration is I don't really have a great, I don't think national politics got us into this mess, by some very bad decisions, but it's not clear to me they can get us out of this mess because, you know, it's kind of like they've opened Pandora's box and we're in a world now where, globalization is a fact. It's very, very hard to move away from that. But to the degree I do believe, you know, to the degree if I do have a political bent these days, it's along the lines of believing in localism. I think you need to return a lot of power to communities to dictate for themselves what works best for their community. And I think so I find it slightly frustrating and I'm sure you guys in Iowa are particularly frustrated or know about us too well because you've had so many candidates in your state recently, but a lot of people proposing all these policy solutions that I think, you know, at the margin can help, but it's more like, it's more at this point like harm reduction, because I think the changes require so much deeper. We have a society that doesn't have a lot of empathy, doesn't have a lot of moral structure, and it just doesn't work for a lot of people who accept those with big resumes. You know, this society works very, very good for people who have very large resumes and have lots of credentials. It doesn't work for people who find their source of identity and their source of meaning in things like faith and things like place, and in the non-material things. And I don't know how to get back to that world.
Are these folks, I will drop one political question in. These folks, and your book doesn't really allude to it, if they had preferences or not. It seems almost like the choice of who they would vote for president is just so far removed from the reality of their daily lives.
That's correct. One of the things early on, my book was missed. You know, I think there was some belief that it was about Trump voters, and it's not. It's about non-voters. And non-voters make up a very large part of the country. You know, there's an extraordinarily large, these people are so, being a non-voter makes sense, actually, for these people, because the system has, screwed them over so much that they just don't feel like there's any point engaging in the process. To the degree they do engage in the process, it's almost at a protest level, and I think that's kind of that's some of what was going on with Trump, is the protest vote of like, you know, I'm so sick of this system that's not working for me. I'm getting tired of losing at chess every time in a system where it's rigged. I might as well just knock the table over. But the bulk of the people in my book just didn't vote, and haven't voted in a long time, and wouldn't vote because, you know, it's just, there's no point for them. It's just another process that's going to get them in trouble, you know, through, or get them jury duty, which they don't really want to deal with, you know?
Well, the last point I'll make is, the book is an excellent read, Chris, but the photography, you mentioned that and I omitted that earlier. The pictures are of these folks in their places, in their communities, and the photos are striking. And if you look at them, as I'm doing right now, thumbing through the book, It could be here in Burlington. It could be in Galesburg, Monmouth, where I, outside of where I live. It can be right around these communities, Fort Madison, Keokuk. I mean, they're real people and they're real stories. And again, it opens, I think it's an eye-opening look at this because, at this issue, because it is so real. And, sometimes we don't want to even look at this. We want to shield our eyes from it, but I think it's necessary. And I think if you want a really good look at this, this is a great book to have. And I really compliment you on writing it, Chris. Anyway, Chris Arnotti has been our guest today. He's the author of this book called Dignity, Seeking Respect in Back Row America. I think we hit most of the topics. We could probably keep talking, but I'm out of time. But Chris, thank you so much for being a guest. Our guest, do you have any ideas on what might be next? Any type of work like this coming up for you?
Yeah, you know, there are, like I said, I drove 350,000 miles over 5 years across the United States. I mean, literally everywhere. And there are about 10 or 15 places that stick in my mind that I wish I had spent more time in, places that I didn't write about in this book that I really would like to go back to and do more in-depth interviews with people and, you know, spend, a far more time in these communities. Places that just, one of them was in Iowa, including, I believe it's called, New Hampton, Iowa, was a town up in the northeast corner that just really struck me, and I've always wanted to spend more time there, and so I'm going to try to do that.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that, and thanks again, Chris, for being our guest today.
All right. Thank you very much.